Hey, everybody. It's Jessica Benson here from the American Ag Network. I feel like I've been a little bit MIA as far as the podcast world goes, but Tuesday I went to the NDSU Extension Research Center in Carrington, North Dakota, and they focused a lot on their research, obviously, and a lot about it. A lot of talk was about the drought and how we can help mitigate some of that stress on ourselves as well as our operations, especially when it comes to livestock. So I recorded audio that day from all of the speakers, or from most of the speakers. It was a bit of a windy day, so maybe some of that audio I wasn't able to recover. But any audio that I missed, I do have some handouts from the speakers that day that will be also linked here. And they're excellent resources for you to help make some better decisions, you know, when it comes to this drought. So nothing about it is easy or simple, but this can certainly help. So I broke up the speakers into a few different parts, and this first speaker will be Dr. Carl Hoppe. He's going to talk about drought management with dry lot cows and calves. After that, it'll be Tim Petrie, and he will talk about economic perspectives for drought. Then we'll have Zach Carlson. He's new to Extension, and he'll be talking about early weaning. And again, I didn't get his audio recorded. The quality was not salvageable, but I do have a handout that he provided with lots of useful information. After that, it was Wade Pickenpaugh speaking, and she talks about feeding alternative grains. Then we have manure management during drought, and that information is provided by Mary Kina. After that, we'll shift to forages, and Kevin Sedovic talks about annual forage options for feeding cattle. After that, it's Ezra Aberle, and he's going to talk about grass establishment on saline soils. So with that, here was the first speaker of that day, Dr. Carl Hoppe.
We've had a dry lot cow herd here at Carrington for more years than I've been here, obviously, and that's been 31. I'm always intrigued. I got my colleague here, Vern Anderson, who's been managing, who is the researcher down here with this dry lot cow herd for decades. And he should probably be giving this talk about the history of where the dry lot cow herd came from and why we're here with this. So I'll give my version of it, and Vern can provide the opportunity to change the story as time goes on. But early in the 70s, they decided to put a cow herd down here in this irrigation station. I was intrigued with that comment of irrigation station in North Dakota. Since I came here a long time ago, it always rained. Lots of rain. Why do we have irrigation when it rained every week an inch? It felt like Iowa, where I came from. So it was wonderful living in North Dakota. And now we've turned into what we see as a drought, and I understand why we have irrigation out here in North Dakota. So originally they were going to put these cows out on irrigated pasture and graze irrigated pasture. The story I understand is the cattle tromp too much grass into the ground, so let's harvest the feed, haul it to the feedlot, and get more productivity or more grass, more forage off the field that way if we irrigate it and harvest it. Nowadays, we'd say, well, wait a minute, we need to rethink that idea because we could add a lot of organic matter to the soil and turn it back into the soil and improve things differently, but that's the history of why we have a dry lot cow herd. This herd has been dry lot for 40 plus years. Originally, it was a Hereford herd. Crossbreeding came in. If you look at the cow's ear tags and it's a red ear tag, that means it was sired by a red Angus. If it's a green ear tag, it was sired by a Simmental, red Simmental. So we've got a red Angus, red Simmental cross. If there's a blue ear tag, that might be out of South Devon. You might see some tiger stripes in the cows. That's from years and years ago of using Territe in the cow herd. But as you can see, these are fairly decent, productive cows, just like most of our cow herds out there. And of course, they're usually friendly up the feed bunk until there's a whole bunch of people around here. Then they obviously drift away like they normally do. Our cow herd is kind of unique. Well, we're a spring calving cow herd. So it's kind of like your own cow herd at home. They're dry lot, they're fed here in the wintertime, except in the summertime in May and June, they're not hauled to grass, they're kept here in feedlot. As you can see, we control the flies, the cattle are in good condition, the cattle look fine. There's really no difficult secret to it, other than you gotta provide a ration to the cattle that meets their nutrient needs. In other words, cows that have a lactational demand, which these are, you need a ration that's 10, 11, 12% crude protein, TDN, 67, 62, oh, I shouldn't say 67, more like a 58 to 62 TDN. Depends if you want the cows to gain or not. My point here is if you ever go out in pasture and select what the cows are grazing, they're grazing a protein that's probably a grass out there that's probably 14 to 16% protein if they have their druthers, and they'll select something soft that's probably a 62 TDN feed. So cattle select out on pasture really good feeds to eat when they have the choice. In a drought like this, they eat whatever they can, lose some weight. Well, that's what will happen in the feed yard here. You got to provide the adequate amount of feed in the feed bunk so they maintain their weight, or usually a half a pound or a pound a day gain, maybe. At least maintain their weight. If they lose weight, then you will run into risk of having cows not breed back. Just like out on pasture with a drought. What's going to happen this fall? We might see a lot of open cows because of the lack of feed out there at this point. We'll just wait and see what happens. But in our cow herd, when you manage the feed bunk correctly, they'll perform quite well. Now remember, when you're feeding the cows, you got to provide some feed for the calves too. So having a slick feed bunk like this is kind of where we go, but there's a creep area over in the corner where the calves can go ahead and graze or eat. Feed. I shouldn't say graze, but eat. You could set up a grazing area if you had a feedlot with a pasture nearby and let the calves escape out there and enjoy a little exercise and green grass. But normally a creep area is what's needed to provide some feed. Tim, I'm going to ask Tim what he fed cattle this morning. Let's see, if I remember right, corn at 5 pounds. What's at 6 pounds? Straw at 6 pounds. So rather than, we don't use hay here anymore, we use straw or stover, and we put up a lot of straw. It's hard to find hay, so we've always traditionally just gone with the straw. Distiller's grains, right? Modified at 13 pounds of modified, that'd be about 6 pounds of dry, and then 30 pounds of corn silage that we harvest in the fall and use throughout the whole year. So that's a pretty simple ration for ingredients. You got the corn silage for the energy and the corn for energy. You got straw for some extra fiber. And you've got the distiller's grains, which we probably get out of spirit wood or Castleton as a protein source, but also doubles as an energy source too. And you'll notice that there's a round bale of straw sitting out in the feeder. That's kind of the buffer out there. Cows get bored when they're in dry lot. Rather than licking the hair off the other cows or licking dirt off the ground, if you've got a round bale of something out there that's not really palatable, but definitely there for them to chew on if they really feel like it, they will, and it prevents some bad habits being developed in your cow herd. We do control the flies. Did you spray for those? Okay, periodically they're sprayed. Do you use wasps or anything like that? Not yet. Probably have in the past. Okay, some places do, some places don't. Cattle look pretty happy, pretty content. So, we're basically a spring calving cow herd, your cow herd, but we had no grass to take them to. We've been doing that for years. For people that are flooded out, droughted out, or lost their pasture, whatever the case is, you don't have to sell cows if you don't have grass. You can dry lot them. A lot of different ways to feed them. Talk to us, any extension agent or nutritionist, on how to feed them, and they can certainly help you through what needs to be done. Nebraska takes a different view when it comes to dry lot cow production. Why do we calve in the spring? That's when there's mud. That's when there's cool temperatures. Why don't we calve in the summertime or maybe in the fall when it's easier? Why don't we calve in an off season so when these calves go to market, they hit a youthful age at the market high rather than a market low? So if you're really into dry lot production, realize that you don't have to be on a spring calving cow herd. You could switch into fall or summer or winter, depending upon where your location is and number of barns. That could certainly work for your dry lot too. A lot of different choices. Once the calves are weaned, they're of course put in our pens here and fed. The cows are going on a diet that's not going to make them gain weight, just maintain weight. If they're in good condition, just maintain. If they're a little thin, then add some extra energy to the ration. No big secret, works really well. Provide a mineral mix as well for the cattle for vitamins A, D, and E, depending upon if that's not in the ration. Balance for trace minerals as well. No big secret here. It works. The real problem, though, and I have to give the disadvantages. Vern did a trial here a few years ago comparing to pasture and cows in the dry lot. Performance of the calves were the same. But when you start doing the math, our pasture prices have always been substantially cheaper than what our feed prices are into a feed bunk. Didn't say the cows weren't unprofitable, I just said it was cheaper to feed when you have cheap grass. At that time, you could afford to go up like $40, $45 an acre for grass before it became just as competitive to go into a feed bunk. Now this year, with double the feed prices, I don't even want to do the math to find out how expensive it might be to feed cows. So that's another challenge, and you can see why guys aren't feeding cattle as such. Going out. I should stop here, but one more comment, and that is early weaning. We wean at about 5 months of age or 6 months of age? 20th of September, and it's a March calving cow herd. Usually I always figure they do calve, you know, most of us, if we wean in November, maybe December, we got a 200-day weaning date for these calves. In dry lot, you can wean earlier because they're already trained to the feed bunk. We usually go about 6 months before we wean. If you need to early wean, that's another whole story, but it can easily be done in the feed yard.
That was a lot to chew on, and maybe some of us might consider raising our cattle on a dry lot after that. The next speaker of the day was Tim Petrie. Mr. Petrie is an associate professor and livestock economist, and he brought us some economic perspectives for drought.
Start off by saying it is going to rain and cattle prices are going to go up. That's a given. The problem is we don't know when and how much. If we knew when and how much, we'd have easy decisions. We wouldn't have to have a very sharp pencil. Be very easy, but we don't know when and how much, so that makes it especially difficult. There are a number of options. My topic, I guess, was should we sell cows or not, and the answer is we depends on how bad your health is, but we already have been. But there are a lot of strategies, and one strategy usually in a drought is not the best one. There's a combination of strategies, and so that's why we have a variety of speakers today. I'm going to talk about early weaning, alternative feeds, and so on, and kind of end up with that. So you need to do a variety of things to get by, and we don't know what all is going to happen there. So there's no cookie cutter nice template to use during a drought because everybody's situation is different, and some get a shower and others don't, and all kinds of alternative feeds, some available to you and some aren't. And so kind of on the extreme side, if you're my age and are going to retire this fall anyway and you're out of grass, the decision's pretty easy. It's been made for you. Sell the cows. That's no problem. If you're a young beginning producer and need to be in business, you've got difficult decisions to make, and there your first stop probably should be your lender, and you have to come up with some plan to help you keep in business. I know it's going to be very, very difficult. For those of you that are in the middle of that, which I suppose you are, for most of you are, then again, it's a combination of things. We've already sold a lot of cattle in North Dakota. The poor performers, most inefficient, and so on, go first. Already sold a lot of heifers into the market that would have went in with a bull. Ironically, we had the fifth largest number of replacement heifers ever on January 1st in North Dakota. And going back, it'd be the mid-70s when we had the three largest. So had more replacement heifers than we've ever had a long time. A drought hits. And so that's why you're seeing all those cattle come to market, and rightfully so. So again, next you go on down the line, and Miranda's been doing a lot of programming on that. We've got webinars and so on, and poor cows and all of that. Usually, and during a drought, corn is our cheapest feed, and it's a good fallback. And again, we got a double whammy this year. Yesterday, ethanol plants were paying $6.20 for corn. Last year, they were, at this time last year, paying $3. So if we had $3 corn, Tim shaking his head because he's buying corn to feed these cattle here, it'd be easier to get through. We'd have half the feed cost, but there's nothing we can do about that, and it's out of our control, and so corn isn't going to bail us out, so that means probably selling deeper into the herds and trying to find more alternative sources. So again, most of you would be a combination of many, many different things to get by. I know one of the questions you're asking, I'm very, very aware prices haven't been that good in the last couple of years. So you're saying, hey, if prices are going to stay like that, should I stay in business? Should I sell out or whatever? Or are there better times ahead? And that's more what I'm going to talk about now, is what are our expectations of prices? So that can give you a better idea. And I will say, I did say prices are going to be better. And so I think your goal should be maintaining a base cow herd of what you can. Again, you're going to have to sell down many of you if you don't have forage and so on, but better times ahead. So with that, let's just go to the charts and go through that. So I'll just start on the upper left-hand side. You know, start off with fed steers because most of you are interested in feeder cattle, I suppose, but the two most important things that affect fed cattle or that affect feeder cattle prices are fed cattle prices and corn. The good news is all cattle prices now are higher than they have been for the last 3 years, higher than they've been the last 3 years right now. So we've seen improvement in prices. Can't hold my sheet steady here. So start off with fed cattle here. Two things that affect cattle, major things, and that's supply and demand. On the supply side, we decreased the cow herd in 2019. We decreased the cow herd in 2020. And I'm sure we're going to decrease the beef cow herd again in 2021. We have high beef cow slaughter. A third of the country is in drought. We're not alone up here. The Southern Plains is the exception. And the Appalachian states kind of turned around back 2010, 11, 12 into 13. The Southern Plains was extremely dry and we were okay up here, and now it kind of flipped. 70% of our pastures are in poor to very poor condition in North Dakota, only 4% in Oklahoma. So they've got a lot of grass down there. I just had a conference call with my counterparts in Colorado, Oklahoma, Texas, Mississippi, and Tennessee last week. And their one complaint was that it's been cooler and wetter than normal and they can't get their hay up. So there you go. It's just opposite of here, just opposite of what it was back in 2011 to 2013. But again, from a cattle price standpoint, that is good because they've got grass down there. And with the high corn prices, we want to keep cattle on forage longer than in a feedlot where corn is over $6. You get down to Texas, they have now about a dollar positive basis over the futures, and so they are able to do that down there. So again, just quickly then, let's go through them. Look at the fed cattle on the top. Again, we started off the year. I like to put the last 3 years on a chart and then the current year, because if it happened in the last 3 years, it can happen again. And so you see we started off 2021 lower than the last 3 years, down there at about 110. We've increased up to 123. These are average U.S. prices, so in the Northern Plains they'd be a couple dollars higher than that. Texas is lower, so now we're up 123, 124 last year, the highest the last 3 years. Those red dots there then are the futures. And so the futures are saying we're going to have continued improvement by October up to 125 and by December up to 131, by far the highest of the previous 3 years. And then the good news is go ahead and go to 2022, all above 132, starting off there in February, 136, by April, 139, then just again jump to December up there about 138. Those are 2016 to 17 prices, so much better than we've experienced in the last few years. And again, the caveat here is that's barring some unfortunate thing. We would have had much, much better prices last year if it wouldn't have been for COVID-19. So then the others follow along that closely. Go to the right-hand side then is 5 to 6 weight calves, 550 to 6 weight calves. Again, the same story there. Red line started below the last 3 years, now above the last 3 years. Again, being supported by excellent grazing conditions in the Southern Plains and a good demand for calves there. They would be higher than that, obviously, if corn hadn't went up. The rule of thumb is change corn 10 cents, change fall calf prices a buck in the opposite direction. So corn is double, they're up about $3. So do the math and see what calves might have been. But again, that's calf prices are still good. They haven't went up as much as fed cattle simply because of corn. Go down to the heavier weight feeder cattle then on the bottom side. Exactly same story there. 154 last week, the best in the last 3 years. And again, looking at what the futures say, a continued improvement in the fall up to 162. We're doing in the low 140s, 140 to 145 the last couple of years, and up to about 150 there in 2018. November futures yesterday closed at 162.10, then go to 2022, all above 162. By midsummer they're up to 165. So good improvement in prices there. But again, go to the right hand side, you see what corn has done. Corn has came off about a dollar, but the corn, we don't even know the final planted acreage. It rained in Iowa, thank goodness, just over the weekend, and so their crop prospects look better. The U.S. prospects came out, and corn improved. I think it's 65% in good to excellent condition, and we need a really, really good corn crop, because, again, remember what the price does if we start going into drought in the Corn Belt, and corn will go higher. So that's the big unknown for fall cap prices, is what's corn going to do. So, again, just end up really struggling up here. Do a combination of things. Prices are going to be better, barring some unfortunate thing. And hang in there and listen to the other speakers. We're probably going to have to do some early weaning. You're going to have to find alternative feeds. CRP haying will open up in 2 weeks. And again, if you have access to that, get into your FSA office, because get the paperwork done, because on August 2nd, early in the morning, you can start doing that and do whatever you need to do. So.
Mr. Petrie sure knows what he's talking about, and he certainly brings a lot of experience to the table. Next, we'll listen to Wade Pickenpah, and she brings us some research they have done on feeding alternative grains such as wheat and how that might affect performance on feeder cattle.
Good morning, everyone. Like she said, I'm Wade Pickenpah, and I'm the research specialist here at the Carrington Research Extension Center. Last summer, we conducted a research project that looked at the impacts of added roughage on feedlot performance, digestibility, and ruminal characteristics on steers fed wheat-based diets. So we decided to do this project as we received a lot of phone calls from producers asking what they can do with an excess of low-quality wheat. So wheat can be used as an alternative grain in a feedlot diet. However, it is more rapidly fermentable than corn, so it can increase the risk of digestive disorders. To offset these disorders, cattle that are fed high grain diets can have an additional roughage in their diet to offset those disorders. It increases the amount of buffers that are entering the rumen, essentially increasing the ruminal pH. And in addition to additional roughage, feeding ethanol co-products such as distillers grains can also offset acidosis, as it is a high protein and low starch feed. So the objective of this study was to evaluate the impacts of including additional roughage, as well as 30% MD modified distillers grains with solubles in feedlot diets that include wheat. So our hypothesis was that increasing dietary roughage would actually decrease feedlot performance. And then we further hypothesized that increasing dietary roughage would reduce digestibility but increase ruminal pH. So for this experiment, there were two studies, the first one being the feedlot study. We utilized 72 feedlot steers that were randomly assigned to one of 12 pens and randomly assigned to a treatment. There were four treatments, the first one being 10% roughage, which was our control diet, a 12%, a 14%, and a 16% roughage diet. As wheat decreased across treatments, straw was replaced instead of the wheat. Study two was a metabolism study that utilized four ruminally and duodenally cannulated steers. And this diet was the treatment diets were the same for this study, except silage was used instead of hay. So there were four periods in this trial, and there were 14 days in each period. The first 7 days were the adaptation period, where they got accustomed to their new diet, and the second 14 days was used for collection period. Collections included duodenal collections, fecal samples, as well as ruminal fluid collection, and those samples helped us determine digestibility, fecal output, as well as ruminal pH and acid concentration. So in the feedlot portion of the study, we actually didn't find any difference in feedlot performance with additional roughage in a wheat-based diet. In metabolism study, addition of roughage also did not affect dry matter intake or digestibility of dry matter, crude protein, or fiber. And as expected, ruminal pH increased with increasing roughage. And it also decreased the amount of propionate in the rumen. Propionate buildup can actually is one of the factors that leads to acidosis. So given these results, we rejected our hypothesis that feedlot performance would decrease with increasing roughage. And we also failed to reject our hypothesis of ruminal pH increasing with additional dietary roughage. So a little bit of a recap. Our data indicated that roughage inclusion in wheat-based diets, including modified distillers grains, increased ruminal pH without having an effect on feedlot performance. So this indicates that producers that are feeding wheat with combination of modified distillers grains with solubles may not need to increase the additional increased roughage in the diet, since we didn't see any acidosis in our cattle. However, more research should be done on lighter weight cattle that may be less accustomed or acclimated to high grain diets, as the cattle that we received for this project was around 1,000 pounds, so they might have been on higher grain diets for a longer period of time, so maybe the wheat didn't affect them as easily as lighter weight cattle would have been.
Lots of great research with beef cattle happening out in Carrington. Next, we had Mary Kina, and she talks about manure management during a drought and maybe some considerations that we might need to think about in such a dry year like we've been having.
But because we're managing the cows differently and our feedlot differently, we're going to have to manage our manure just a little bit differently. So in the summer, during a drought, we might be dry lotting more. So we talked about dry lotting this morning. We just got done talking about our feedlot. So maybe we have our cows in our pens longer. Maybe you haven't turned out yet. Maybe you kept them a month longer than normal. Maybe you're going to bring them in early. Maybe you're going to wean early. So you're going to have the calves in sooner. They're going to be doing their business in the pens sooner or more than expected. And so because of that, we might have less bedding than we normally would in the winter, but we are going to have a different nutrient content. And so our winter manure is going to be a little bit different than our summer manure, especially based on what we're feeding them. So maybe we're feeding early weaned calves versus our maintenance cows. Maybe we're feeding cows that are lactating like we are in our feedlot pens versus backgrounding steers. And so the physiological state of where those cows are is going to, or where those cattle are going to affect the nutrients in the manure. And really that's because of what we're feeding them. So we feed our calves, our newly weaned calves, different than we feed our cows that are on maintenance versus what we feed our bulls that are done doing their job. And so everything is fed differently. And so the manure nutrient content is gonna be different. And so the best way to know what the nutrient content of your manure is to sample it. So if you call me and say, hey, what's the average of manure? I can tell you an average, but man, it's gonna be hard for me to tell you actually what yours is. So it's really easy to sample it. So Lynette had mentioned that there are some extension agents here today, and we actually have some on this tour. So if you're from Wells County, Lindsay Maddock is here. So Lindsay's on the trailer. And if you're from Kidder County, Penny Nestor is here. And so Penny's also on the trailer. So my extension agents, they know how to sample manure, but they also know how to get a hold of me in case they're not sure. Then they can call me and we can sample manure, or I can tell you how to do that. We have a super easy new bulletin that walks through with pictures on exactly how to do that, or we can just talk about it. And so sending that sample in, typically I would like you to get a breakdown of nitrogen, so what kind of nitrogen is in there, availability wise, and then P and K. So nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium are typically the things that you're going to look for. And so that'll be anywhere from 40 to, we can go all the way up to about $150, depending on what you're looking for. So you can get all of the nutrients in your manure. You can get the pH, the salts, the carbon, so you can get everything or just a few nutrients that you need. So sampling is the best way to know how to manage your manure differently during a drought. Okay, more manure, more loads to haul, and more money. And so be up front. Okay, so that's what my notes say. So that whole little line is to tell you, okay, so more manure because we have our cattle in longer, earlier, or more of them in our pens. Makes more manure, makes more loads to haul. That's expensive. So I work with our manure haulers. I love those guys. They're a great group to work with. but their equipment is expensive. And so in turn, they have to charge you for that. So they don't mind if you say, you know, I have 200 loads to haul, but I can only pay you for 100. Okay, they'll haul 100 loads. They're good with that. But if you tell them I have 200 to haul and then they haul 200 and you only pay them for 100, that kind of chaps them a little bit, right? Because they have their equipment to maintain too. And so a really great conversation that I actually had back in 17 during that drought with our manure haulers was just be upfront with us, guys. It's okay. We're most of them are producers too, and they get it. So if you can only haul 100, just haul 100. Haul what you can. Weed seed management. So we are getting a lot of feeds from out of the area. Very likely we're going to be hauling in feeds, alternative feeds that we talked about just a little bit ago, things that we haven't fed, things from out of state, different kinds of forages we're probably going to be bringing in. And so along with that comes their weeds. And so we have to manage those. One way to manage those is through manure. And one way to do that is through composting. So lucky for you, we're having a composting workshop here tomorrow from 8 to 4:30. All day long, we're going to be immersed in composting. And so you can still sign up for that. You can talk to me after the tour today. I'll be at lunch, so you can come chat with me about composting manure. But that is really one way to manage those weed seeds, especially the noxious weeds or troublesome weeds. So not only are we piling the manure, we're turning it. So we're getting the breakdown, we're reducing the volume, less loads to haul, but also we're killing the weed seeds, we're killing the pathogens, and we're making a more nutrient stable product.
Next, we have Kevin Sedovic. He's going to talk about annual forage options and maybe something that we can consider about planting when we are short on feed this year during drought.
So my topic today is annual forages, and I thought about how to approach this. Should I talk about annual forages as a whole? You know, this year's been a little bit odd with the drought. We get a lot of calls on what should I seed for an annual forage. So I took the approach that if I got a phone call from producers, you know, what usually they ask or what is the issues that they want to talk about? And so, you know, the first thing when I get a phone call is I ask him or her, what do they want to use it for? Are they looking for an annual forage for a hay crop? Are they looking for something more as a grazing crop? And you get the call where I want to use it for both. I want to take it off for hay, and then I want to come back and I want to graze it. You never hear them come back and say, I want to graze it first and then hay it, because that rarely doesn't work the best. So you look at those scenarios, you know, and usually when I ask a producer, you know, what is the time frame that you want to harvest that forage crop? Because it comes down to what's your availability. Are you looking at putting something up in the month of June or July or August? And there's actually plants that you can put in that will fit all those scenarios. I mean, if you're looking at even an early June option are your winter cereals, like a winter rye. You know, we put our winter rye up about June 5th, and we put up our winter wheat about June 20th. You know, so the opportunities are there for throughout that time period. If you have a cool season crop, you're looking at more of the early part of July to mid-July. And if you're looking at harvesting something in the month of late July into August, even into September, you'll look at a warm season crop. And so once you figure out what's your availability of time and when you want to put that up, you'll pick and select based on that. This year was a bit different with the drought. You're like, we had no rain early, so we didn't plant a cool season. Then we looked at a warm season, where you got some moisture early. And it's really funny, across the state this year, there was areas that got some spring moisture and the cool seasons looked great. But then the rain shut off and you put a warm season in and they didn't do it worth a dang. We planted some millet 3 weeks ago and I swear it hasn't got an inch tall. It's just, we haven't had the rain. So this year's been really tricky with what you're gonna plant. So the other thing they always ask is, I want tonnage. If you're gonna plant a forage crop, I want as much tonnage as I can get. And usually when you go high tonnage, there are some issues, there are some risks. The higher tonnage grasses are gonna be your warm season crops, but they have caveats to them. The other then you follow up, well, I want some quality with my tonnage. And normally quality can go with tonnage depending on what your species are. Then last, and I'm always surprised, with some producers it's cost is first, but most of the time cost is not the first issue. It's I want some tonnage, what's the quality, and then what's the cost of them. And there's quite a bit of variability in costs of what you pick for an annual cereal crop or an annual forage crop. And then dealing with droughts, it's been a different ball game this year in what you're gonna plant. So let's just look at the first question. What's your highest producing annual forages? And they're almost always gonna be a warm season crop. Now, I'm not gonna count corn, I'm not gonna count your sorghums, but on the average, your sorghum sedans, your highest producing or highest tonnage warm season crop. Sorghum sedan comes with caveats. Trying to get it dry. If you got a high producing grass, You got to make sure you have a conditioner or a hay bind to get it dry enough so you don't have put up a bunch of moldy hay. The other is prussic acid. So this year, in a drought year, we have stressed plants. Toxicities will be high on almost anything, whether it's a prussic acid or nitrate toxicity because of the drought. Stress creates these increases in toxicity. So you're going to want to, if you, this year in particular, I would test all of my sorghum sedans for prussic acid. The next one on my list is one of them that's kind of tricky, is pearl millet. So pearl millet in a nice heat, good moisture, can be as productive as sorghum sedan. But it's a really finicky grass. If it doesn't have heat or it doesn't have water, it produces even lower than the foxtail millets. So it's one of those that, it's one, on a risk, you know, if I have a good growing season in the spring and you got some good moisture and it looks like it's gonna be a warm summer, pearl millet's an option. This year would have been a great option for pearl millet if we'd had some rain. But it's not a great option this year, in my opinion. The one I have after that is sedan grass. And sedan grass is probably one of your safe, even though it's got prussic acid, it's a safer grass. It does a little better in drier conditions than the sorghum sedans and pearl millet. You still have prussic acid issues. The nice thing about sedan grass, if you get moisture late, it will regrow. And you can get some grazing value off it as long as it's a safe feed. Then you kind of fall into the foxtail millets. I do like foxtail millet. It's one of them safer grasses that you can put in. You can almost always grow a foxtail millet, except for this year. During the drought years, probably my number one grass I recommend is Siberian foxtail millet. It seems to be the most drought resilient. It kind of feeders out. It's a scavenger and seems to do the best. Now ours, we planted Siberian millet and it's literally an inch tall. So it does still take rain. And I tell us with producers, you know, we can look at emergency feeds, but it still takes rain. You still have to have some moisture for it to grow. The one I have for that are the Proso and Japanese millets. I've never used those two. I just don't like them that much, and that's a bias on my side. I need to probably test more, and we do have them on our test trials at Streeter that we'll see next week. And then the one that gets a lot of press is teff grass. So how many heard of teff grass? So it's a warm season small grain. It probably gets more popular press in the popular magazines than anything else. And it is by far my least favorite grass, because it takes water and heat, and it's not very competitive. So we've tried teff 3 years in a row, not 3 years in a row. 1 year I didn't want to do it, but my manager decided to do it and didn't tell me. But that's beside the point. It always fails for us. It takes both heat and water, and it's not very competitive. If you're looking for an option to go under pivot and you got water, it's a great option because you can get 2 and 3 cuttings off that grass, and it works great in that scenario. And it seems to be very popular in the horse market. So it tends to be one that's used in the horse industry as a feed, especially in the northern plains, but it does take a lot of water. So those are my warm seasons in terms of kind of order of high producing. Then when you look at the high quality grasses, I tend to look at my cool seasons as my higher quality. That's not a across the board true statement, but I do like my cool seasons, especially forage barley. It's probably my more palatable, higher quality feed. And then you follow from there, actually pearl millet and teff are also very good quality feeds. But those two are also my most riskiest in terms of weather conditions, in terms of moisture and water. The oats in particular really like moist years. If you have a moist year, they'll be by far your most productive cereal crop. On a dry year, it almost doesn't matter. There's some variability among them, among those varieties, but oats comes down. And so they don't seem to be quite as spread out as you'll see on a wet year. And so when we look at the oats, I always talk to producers, you know, how you want to feed that annual forage. If you're gonna grind that feed, your flexibility goes all over the board, because you can pick about anything you want that you can blend off with silage or whatever you're gonna feed. So the triticales on the average are the highest in lignin content, and you'll have a very tough time feeding that in a bale feeder, especially if you put up a little bit late. So it's one of those that is a grinding feed. You have tonnage. The beauty of triticale is it's the highest protein of all the grasses that we have for cool seasons. There's variability among the varieties, but it tends to be higher in terms of protein. If you're looking for something that you can feed in a bale or roll out in the field, your forage barley is your best option. It's low in lignin content. Cows love it. They'll clean it up. And it kind of fits that window where you're not going to grind it and do a TMR. And then you got oats. And oats is kind of in the middle there. And there's some varietal differences among the oats that I've seen. And it also varies by year. But oats, depending on the variety and when you put it up, if you put it up in the milk stage versus the soft dough stage, you can feed some of them in the bale. but it gets even tricky with some of the oats. If you're putting it up past the soft dough, it's just like triticale. You're going to probably want to grind it to be the most efficient in getting that used through the animal. And so based on what you can do, what you can't do, you will select based on your management probably more than anything else. And then look at your varieties that you want to look at or what your choices are, if that makes sense. So the last thing I'm going to talk about are cover crops. So cover crops are another great option for forages. Normally the cover crops are used in the grazing scenarios. So if I know a producer wants to graze his annual forages, I will almost always go with the cover crop mix. It takes away some of your risk and you get some highs and lows within that cover crop mix. I'm not a big fan of a 20-way mix. I like my 6, 7, 8, 9-way mixes, and I like to have my costs cheap. If I can put in a cover crop for 15 to 20 bucks an acre, I'm happy. And if it would rain and it would grow, I'm even happier. Our cover crop did not grow this year. It literally failed. We have kochia. That's what we got. And so when you look at the cover crop, so you're normally going to look at a warm season grass, a cool season grass. The brassicas are very popular in the cover crop mixes. You'll put a broadleaf in there, and then you'll put a legume in there. The one that I always kick out first, because I'm always looking at costs, are the legumes. Legumes are your most expensive seed in that mix. And if you don't need to have a legume in that mix, that's the first thing I take out, and it's strictly a function of cost. Doesn't mean the legume doesn't have value. It does. But if I'm looking at cost, that's the one I usually kick out. If I know I'm going to put it up, if I get the production, if I have the moisture that year, and I'm going to seed early enough, then I will put a legume in my mix. If you want to hay that cover crop first, you'll reduce the brassicas in your mix. It's very difficult to put up a cover crop mixed with brassicas in because there's too much water. The brassicas run about 75 to 80% moisture. Can you think about drying that down for one? And then when you do dry it down, it shatters. So if I know I'm gonna hay it first, lower the brassicas, don't take them all out because you want the brassica regrowth after you harvest it. But I'm gonna, instead of going a pound or pound and a half, I might only go a half a pound. And then the broadleafs, you know, I like broadleafs in a mix because it just gives you some different diversity, different rooting depths, trying to build soil at the same time. And that's kind of the beauty of cover crops. So you can kind of get a feed base and a soil health base. And so that's kind of where I look at my cover crops, what to think about. I'm going to stop there because I'm sure I'm long. I tend to be winded at times.
Again, some very useful, in-depth information. And lastly, we have Ezra Aberle, and he's going to talk about grass establishment on saline soils.
I'm going to go over a little bit of work that we've done. I couldn't find this on our website since things have changed, but if you do a quick search, just do ND ARS CREC saline grass. This will be the first thing that pops up, and this will give you all the tonnage and quality data and all the different species that we tested. So how many people here have saline areas on their farm? Everybody, right? So how many of us still try to plant through these with an annual crop? How much money do we make on those acres? Zero. But we still have our input costs. So what are some other things that we can do in these areas to try and recoup some of the value? So for agronomic purposes, when we have a EC, electroconductivity, that's how we measure salinity. When you have an EC above 4, that's when the ground is considered saline agronomically. We have a lot of crops like soybeans that are done at about an EC of 2. Some of the best crops that we have that will do will at least yield somewhat at an EC of 4 are barley, sunflowers, and sugar beets. And we've replaced a lot of those in our traditional rotations with soybeans, corn, dry beans, and those are some of our least tolerant crops. So when we have these saline areas, it's actually a water management issue because the salts don't go anywhere on their own. The salts are dissolved in the water. So what happens is we have around those sloughs, you'll see a white ring around all of them. Or if you go east in the valley, you see parallel to all the roads. So where the water sits, or you have a high water table, then you have capillary rise, which is if you think of how a paper towel works. When you set it on your spill, you watch it, it'll draw up into that paper towel. That's capillary rise. So depending on your soil type, you know, that can be anywhere from 2 feet on a sand to almost 7 or 8 feet in a loam or a clay loam soil. So if your water table is within that distance of the surface, you can actually get water come up to the surface with those dissolved salts. The water evaporates and the salt just accumulates. So that's why we're really seeing these issues in the last 30 years, how they just keep getting worse and worse and worse as we keep that conveyor belt going, just keep bringing those salts to the surface. So we looked at a bunch of different species of cool season grasses, and we looked at a bunch of different alfalfas as well. So the best thing you can do in these areas, if you're trying to get some kind of, if you can no longer grow an annual crop, so when you get to those areas that most of you guys, the best thing you could do is do a soil test to figure out what your EC's are. I'm going to give you a couple of quick, easy visuals that most of us are familiar with. So when we get to those areas where all the foxtail barley and the kochia is growing, that's where we can establish some of these more salt tolerant cool season grasses. And if you're really trying to mitigate that water, what you need to do is come in right next to that area where you still got some wheat growing, you still got some barley growing, but it's 5, 10, maybe 17 bushels if you're lucky. And that's a strip in there, 40 to 80 feet wide, whatever your planters are. That is where you would put the alfalfa in if you were going to try and mitigate these areas. Because alfalfa is a very deep-rooted crop, and what you're doing is you are intercepting that water before it gets to the slough or that area where it can come up and evaporate and accumulate. So, are there any questions? We tested a lot of different species in here. Most of them are cool season. To my knowledge, this is the only place that they have New High and AC Saltlander, which are two kind of introduced species that are just side by side. And they are both very salt tolerant, almost as salt tolerant or as salt tolerant as tall wheatgrass. Tall wheatgrass we can get up here. But it's about half a step above cattails as far as feed value goes. The new AC Saltlander and the New High are putting up the same numbers as far as quality, TDN, and protein as smooth brome, which is what everybody's familiar with. That was our check, because that's what's growing in all the ditches around here. So. It's highly variable just going out there and looking at the sites. Typically, when you get to the areas where there is no longer any wheat or barley growing, you're at an EC of probably 6-ish to 7. Where the foxtail barley and the kochia is growing, that's going to put you somewhere between usually about a 7 and a 9. Once you get past about 14, 15, that's when it looks like that piece of paper there. And you're not, I haven't found anything yet that we can get growing in those areas. So what we're doing is we're, in this particular study, we started out in the good ground and we planted all the way down into the white spot to see how far can we successfully establish this to a, you know, to a stand that we can actually utilize and harvest. And all that data is in there. The AC Saltlander, the New High, and the Tall are all rated very good. We've got good stands into ECs of about 9.5, 10. We have a little bit of growth all the way out to a 14 on some of those, but that's when you get kind of into a thinner stand. But it's a way for us to plant something to utilize those acres, and if nothing else, at least keep these areas from getting bigger. You know, typical seed cost for this, these grasses, you're looking at about $80 to $100 an acre to get it in the ground. Now everyone goes, oh yeah, that's a lot, but this is over multiple years. It's not like it's a one-time, you know, it's not like it's an annual basis. We plant this once, and if we get a toehold in there, we've got something growing for the next 4 or 5 years.
So there you have it. There's the audio that I got from that day. There were several other tours, and if I put audio together for everything that happened that day, we'd be listening for hours and hours, and maybe that wouldn't be such a bad thing, but I try to keep this short enough so that people wouldn't lose interest. Anywho, I hope you got a lot of useful information from the NDSU Extension Center in Carrington. There was one guy I did miss, Zach Carlson. He's new to NDSU Extension, and he's a livestock specialist as well. But he did have a handout, and he talked about early weaning of calves, and I will link that somewhere so it's easily accessible to you guys, and it's just got some information and some considerations we should be thinking about if we're going to go the route of weaning our calves early. This is the American Ag Network. Thank you for tuning into our Eye on Extension program.